Right, good morning, brethren across here in the United Kingdom, and of course, good afternoon to those of you in the North American area. Today we're going to continue our Bible study on the book of Exodus, and I do hope, I plan to actually complete the book of Exodus. There's quite a few chapters still to go, but for several chapters they do rather repeat details of the tabernacle that we've already studied in some depth. So when I get to those parts, I'm expecting to just skip through them rather rapidly. That should allow us, I hope, to complete the book. And it may be, as I said in an email a couple of days ago, we might go slightly beyond the 1.25 hours, but I'll try not to. I'll try and move along, and I'll also try and resist the temptation to look at too many other cross-references. We'll pick up the story where we left last week in Exodus chapter 33. We find Exodus chapter 33. This was just after the sort of rather disgraceful event where when Moses was up the mountain talking to God, that Aaron and the people got involved in a rather disgraceful orgy, drunkenness, singing and dancing, and lewd behavior, resulting in Moses coming back down the mountain, tossing the tablets of the Ten Commandments and smashing them, and so on. And really a very unsavory episode in Israel's history, particularly bearing in mind that God was present at the top of the mountain, not very far away from them. So continuing now in Exodus chapter 33. Then the Eternal said to Moses, "Depart and go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your descendants I will give it." So this was the promised land, and that's where these people were scheduled to go. "And I will send my angel," or an angel, "before you, and I will drive out the Canaanite and the Amorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people." And when the people heard these grave tidings, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. Because God had just told them, "Look, you are such a difficult people. You are so prone to sin. You are so utterly carnal. Your behavior has been so disgraceful. I'm not going up with you. I'll send an angel before you, one of my messengers, but not me. You are just too evil for me to live with. You provoke me to anger too often. So I'm not going up." And of course, when the people heard that, they thought, "Uh-oh, a strange land. Enemies, and God's not going with us? Oh dear, that's not good news." And of course, for you and me, if we were ever facing a situation where God was not going to go with us, I think we'd be rather nervous and unhappy too. Verse 5, "For the Eternal had said to Moses, say to the children of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. I could come up in your midst in one moment and consume you. Now therefore, take off your ornaments, that I may know what to do with you." Taking off their ornaments was at least a outward physical sign of some sort of repentance. How deep it would be, we can't always tell, but at least they should look humble and contrite after their disgraceful recent behavior. Verse 6. "So the children of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments by Mount Horeb. Moses took his tent and pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, and called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. And it came to pass that everyone who sought the Eternal went out to the Tabernacle of Meeting, which was outside the camp." Now, some translations are not very good at this point, the one I'm using being one of them, because pretty much the word tabernacle and tent is actually the same Hebrew word. It just means tent. And we translate it once as tabernacle, another time as tent, in the same verse or the same chapter, it really is a bit misleading. The word for tabernacle, in terms of all the things we've been reading about, the courtyard and the skins and curtains and ornaments and so on, is a separate word. So here it looks like Moses took his own official tent, moved it right outside the camp, away from these, frankly, carnal and disobedient people, and he would expect to meet with God out there, away from these rascals. Verse 8. So it was, whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle or tent, that all the people rose, and each man stood at his tent door, and watched Moses until he had gone into the tabernacle or tent. And it came to pass, when Moses entered the tabernacle or tent, that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle or tent, and the Eternal talked with Moses, which would have been, I think, quite impressive to these people. Up until this point, they'd seen the cloud, the pillar, the smoke high up in the mountain. But now this strange cloud descended all the way down the mountain by several thousand feet and actually came right over Moses' tent. And of course, I think they guessed that the Creator God was, you know, hidden by this cloud that had burned, and that Moses was right there talking almost face to face with God himself. And all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the tabernacle or tent door, and all the people rose and worshipped, each man in his tent door. So the Eternal spoke to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend. And he would return to the camp, but his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle or tent. So, I mean, Moses was a very, very privileged man, and to actually stand there face to face talking to God, who, having said that, was actually somewhat hidden by the cloud and the smoke and the fire. But nonetheless, an amazing privilege. And yet, we shouldn't forget that actually we also can talk to God at any time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you wanted to speak to President George Bush, or over here we wanted to speak to perhaps our Prime Minister, it'd be almost impossible. It's very hard. But we have something here which is an even greater privilege, that you and I can just turn our minds towards the Eternal God and start communicating with him as sons and daughters instantaneously. So our privileges in many ways are actually greater even than Moses. Verse 12, then Moses said to the Eternal, see, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found grace in my sight. You're saying to me, God, that I'm a friend of yours, that you know me by name, we have an intimate relationship, that you say I've found grace in your sight, we are supposed to be very close, but you've not told me yet, who's going to go with us? You're sort of implying you're not going. So who's going to help? Who's going to provide the miracles? Who's going to defend us against, the enemy? You're not telling me the whole story. Verse 13, now therefore I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you, and that I may find grace in your sight, and consider that this nation is your people. Don't forget them either. And he, God, said, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. And Bullinger, who wrote the Companion Bible, says this in the Hebrew might actually be a question, and perhaps the correct translation would be, shall my presence go with you, and shall I give you rest? God's asking the question. You've been so carnal, so difficult a people, it's hard for me. So shall I go with you? Will I give you rest? Verse 15, then Moses said to God, well, if your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here. If you're not going to go, God, we don't want to go without you. For how then will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us? So we shall be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth. So, you know, Moses was talking to God, which is what prayer is. And he's being quite bold. You know, God, please go with us. If you don't go with us, well, let's not go anywhere at all. I'd rather not move out of this area unless I'm assured, God, that you will be with us. That's what we want. We are your people. Don't desert us at this stage. How can we possibly be separate from the nations around us if you leave us at this vital point of our history? So he's putting quite a good case before God and being quite bold, as really you and I must also at times be. We must be very reverent talking to God, respect who he is, but he has given us many privileges, one of which is to come boldly to the throne of grace when we need, you know, help. And God expects us to be bold, and as bold as Moses was. Verse 17, then the Eternal said to Moses, okay, I will also do this thing that you have spoken, for you have found grace in my sight, and I do indeed know you by name. You're right, Moses, we are close. I know you by name, that is to say, I really know you inside and out. You're my man. You do have grace in my sight. I do have great favor and fondness for you. Your request, Moses, is a very fair one. Okay, it's done. Verse 18, Moses perhaps getting even more bold at this point. Please show me your glory. Then he said, I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim or explain the name of the Eternal before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But he said, you cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live. So you're saying, okay, Moses, that's quite a brave request, and I'm going to do a lot for you, but you won't actually see my face. Nobody sees my face and can live. Verse 21, and the Eternal said, here is a place by me, and you shall stand on the rock. So it shall be, while my glory passes by, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and will cover you with my hand while I pass by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face you shall not see. So Moses is going to get the opportunity of actually seeing the back of Almighty God. Really, you know, quite astounding if you think about it. I guess we can use our imaginations and wonder quite how this would have happened. But I suspect something like, you know, God would go past and then Moses would look and see the back of a man's head, shoulders, the garments, perhaps the arms swinging as this amazing Eternal being walks past off into the distance, surrounded by fire burning and the smoke and the clouds curling. So Moses gets literally a view of the back of God just a few feet away, perhaps near enough to reach out almost and touch, but not to see the face. That was not permitted to Moses. And of course, you can in a sense envy Moses and say, this is fantastic that Moses could see the back of God from just perhaps 6 or 8 feet away. I mean, just how fantastic is that? But then you think, well, hold on. In the world tomorrow, you and I, when we are born again in the family of God, we'll get to see Jesus and the Father face to face. Much more close, much more real, much more permanent than the little glimpse that Moses had. And I suspect, you know, from what I believe I know of the Father and Jesus, that it'll be a very, very close relationship. I can envisage quite easily that in the eternity to come, there'll be many, 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 many occasions when Jesus Christ will reach his arm across our shoulders and walk side by side with us and talk to us with his arm over our shoulders, because we're his brothers and sisters. Equally, I'm sure that individually, the Father will come up to us, hug us, stand with us, walk with us, sit down and talk to us face to face in that perfect family relationship which will last forever and ever and ever. So although we can, you know, look at Moses' experience and think just how unbelievable that was, what lies ahead for you and me, if we make it all the way through, is more close relationship with the Father and Jesus that lasts forever. So ours is even more exciting. Chapter 34. And the Eternal said to Moses, cut two tablets of stone like the first ones, and I will write on these tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. Because Moses was so distressed when he saw the orgy, he just tossed these things down in absolute disgust. Verse 2. So be ready in the morning, and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai, and present yourself to me there on the top of the mountain. This was makes seven times in all that Moses had to climb this mountain. So I guess he was fairly fit by now. I don't know how high the mountain was. Wild guess, 3,000 feet, 4,000 feet, 5,000 feet, don't know for sure. But if you've got to walk up this seven times over the course of a few weeks, I think you'd be in a fairly good condition. And no man shall come up with you, and let no man be seen throughout all the mountain. Let neither flocks nor herds feed before that mountain. You know, it's going to be kept, keep carnal people and animals away. Just you, Moses, and me. So he cut two tablets of stone like the first ones. Then Moses rose early in the morning and went up Mount Sinai as the Eternal had commanded him. And he took in his hand the two tablets of stone. So that suggests they weren't particularly big tablets, because both of them, it looks like, were in his hand. So not sort of great big heavy things, required two hands to sort of hug them to your chest and so on, but two perhaps thinner, perhaps like slabs, like shale or something, which you could write on. Verse 5, then the Eternal descended in the cloud and stood before him there and proclaimed, or explained, the name of the Eternal. And the Eternal passed before him and proclaimed, so this would be the fulfillment of God's promise to Moses, I'm going to put my hand over you, I'm going to go past you, and I'm going to release my hand, and you're going to see the back part of me as I so walk away. And this would be that particular experience of Moses. And the Eternal passed before him and proclaimed, to me, the Eternal God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. It's interesting there that we sometimes lump all sin together, but God talks here about forgiving iniquity and something else called transgression and something else called sin. And if we do look closely, we find that, you know, sin is not just one thing. There's varieties of sin. And there's at least three mentioned here, iniquity and transgression and sin. Carrying on, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation. Now, you can read that several ways. One is that God is very vindictive, which doesn't fit the context, of course. Saying that, well, you know, God visits the father's iniquities all the way down for several generations. That's really most cruel. That's not compassionate. That doesn't sound very merciful. But the other way of looking at it, which is perhaps makes more sense in context, is that rather than God punishing the fathers and their generation in full, that God sort of rather spreads the punishment over several generations to make it a bit less for each particular generation. And sort of works out, in a sense, not quite as horrific for those that sin in the beginning, because it is spread over several more, and in that sense it rather weakens or dilutes the punishment as far as God can do that. Verse 8, so Moses made haste and bowed his head toward the earth and worshipped, because he'd just seen God close up. He'd heard God proclaiming his name, which explains that I'm a God that keeps mercy for thousands, I forgive all these various things, and so on. And Moses was, you know, quite properly humbled by that, and bowed down and worshipped. Then he said, verse 9, if now I have found grace in your sight, O Lord, Let my Lord, I pray, go among us, even though we are stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your inheritance. So, you know, Moses was a remarkable man, and his timing was obviously quite superb, because here, you know, God had just said, I am Jehovah, I am a God who is merciful and forgives iniquity and transgression. And Moses says, whilst we're talking about that, God, how about you actually do go up with us, and you do forgive us our iniquity and our transgression, and pardon us, and that you do take us as your special treasure. And of course, the timing was perfect. Verse 10, and he, God, said, behold, I make a covenant. This is another one, I suppose. Before all your people, I will do marvels, such as have not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Eternal. For it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. If we think about it, it's been pretty miraculous and awesome up till now to have destroyed the Egyptian Empire with all those plagues, to have taken a slave people out of Egypt through the waters of the Red Sea, to destroy the armies of the Egyptian Empire, to provide manna and water in the wilderness was already pretty awesome. But even more, of course, was to come when the people would go into the Promised Land. Verse 11. This is all part now of God's covenant, a very important key principles. Observe what I command you this day. Behold, I am driving out from before you the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. I'm going to push them out of the land and create space for you. Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you're going, lest it be a snare in your midst. You know, God was saying, look, I, Jehovah, am making a covenant with you. Do not you think of making a covenant with these people when you get there. Don't do it. Don't associate. Keep yourself separate from them. Verse 13, but you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images. For you shall worship no other God, for the Eternal, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods, and make sacrifice to their gods, and one of them invites you, and you eat of his sacrifice, and you take of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters play the harlot with their gods, and make your sons play the harlot with their gods. So the danger is that if you associate with these people, get close to them, rather than you, in a sense, converting them, they are going to pull you down. I think that's often the experience we have in life, that it's very easy to be dragged down. It's very hard to bring other people up. I think many women in their lives have often thought that they found some no good and thought, well, when I marry him, he'll change and become a far better person because I'm going to sort of lift him up and improve his character. And most of the time, it doesn't happen. The reverse is usually the most common, that people get pulled down in their lives. It's much easier to get pulled down and go into the world than to move away from it. And God knew that. He's saying, look, when you get to this country, don't get close to the people, and watch out especially for their religions, because, you know, you will get drawn away. And of course, we know from history that they paid no attention to God, and they did in fact associate with these nations, and they did get drawn away. And finally, hundreds of years later, the entire nation of Israel went into captivity. So they didn't learn from this warning. Verse 17, you shall make no molded gods for yourselves. You know, don't imitate or copy these nations. And then God was making it plain that this is what you should do. You know, don't follow their religious practices, but here's what you should do. Verse 18, the feast of unleavened bread you shall keep. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you, in the appointed time of the month of Abib. For in the month of Abib you came out from Egypt. So, fair enough, keep the feast of unleavened bread for 7 days. That's what you should do. not playing around with these other pagan gods and their various feast days. Verse 19, all that open the womb are mine, and every male firstling among your livestock, whether ox or sheep, is also mine. But the firstling of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. If you will not redeem him, then you shall break his neck. All the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest or cease from your labors. In plowing time and in harvest you shall rest. You know, God knew human nature, and the temptation in terms of resting on God's Sabbath day is that, well, I don't mind doing that when things are quiet in the business and nothing else is happening, but surely God would expect us when it's harvest time and all that work is to be done and there's so many deadlines to be met, surely God would understand if just occasionally we'd work in the Sabbath, wouldn't he? Because, after all, we've got limited time available. You want to get so many days to harvest before the weather changes and so on. So surely, and God knew that would be the reasoning or the attempted justification. So he says, look, you keep the Sabbath, whether it's quiet or whether you're ever so busy, you keep the Sabbath. Verse 22, and you shall observe the Feast of Weeks of the first fruits of wheat harvest, which is coming up just 2 weeks' time. 2 weeks tomorrow is Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks, and also the Feast of Ingathering at the year's end. Now, in my inspired marginal notes, I used to have a reference there that the term at the year's end means the autumn equinox. I got that from Dr. Herman Hay, one of his articles about the true Hebrew calendar. I've since found out that, in fact, it's not the autumn equinox. So I've now crossed out that inspired marginal note, and I've realized that at the year's end means at the year's end, which really is talking about the end of the agricultural year. You know, you've prepared the land, and you've sowed the seed, and the crops have grown, and the summer has passed, and autumn has arrived, or fall, and you bring in the harvest, and that's the end of the growing season. That's the year's end, and that's when you keep the Feast of Ingathering, or we call it nowadays, more often, the Feast of Tabernacles. Verse 23, three times in the year all you men shall appear before the Eternal God of Israel. For I will cast out the nations before you and enlarge your borders. Neither will any man covet your land when you go up to appear before the Eternal your God three times in the year. You know, God will protect your possessions. So go up with a peaceful mind and keep these holy day seasons. Verse 25, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leaven, nor shall the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover be left until morning. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring to the house of the Eternal your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Now, we came across that a few chapters ago, the same statement, don't boil a young kid in its mother's milk. And it does seem, from what historians can work out, that very often the pagans did have a sort of religious practice where a newborn kid would be actually, you know, boiled in the milk of his own mother. Then they'd take that milk and sprinkle it over their fields and so on as some sort of fertility sort of rite. And, you know, God says, don't do that. Don't follow the ways of these people. And from that, of course, you've also got the kosher laws today, where the Jews won't usually allow you to drink milk or have butter if there's any meat on the table. Verse 27. Then the Eternal said to Moses, write these words, for according to the tenor of these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So he was there with the Eternal 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. There were several occasions when Moses went 40 days and 40 nights fasting. The guy was in pretty good condition. Verse 29. That was so when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, and the two tablets of the testimony were in Moses' hand when he came down from the mountain. that Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone while he talked with them. So when Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. I guess you would be. They must have been themselves still rather guilty and sensitive after the last episode, because the last time Moses was up the mountain is when they all went to pot. He's gone again for 40 days, comes back down again, and lo and behold, when he approaches them, unknown to Moses, his face is actually bright and shining, and a light blazing forth from it. And they're thinking, what's happened to Moses? And getting all very nervous and probably all starting to retreat and back off. And you go first, you talk to Moses, I'll just hide at the back here for a while. And so they're all getting a little bit sort of agitated by what appears to be Moses, looks like him, but look at his face. It's bright and glowing. Then Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, all the children of Israel came near, when eventually they were satisfied that nothing too much to worry about, and he gave them his commandments, all that the Eternal had spoken with him on Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil on his face. But whenever Moses went in before the Eternal to speak with him, he would take the veil off until he came out, and he would come out and speak to the children of Israel whatever he had been commanded. And whenever the children of Israel saw the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face shone, then Moses would put the veil on his face again until he went to speak with God. So his veil was off and on his face all the time. When he'd wander into the tent to speak to God, he'd take the veil off, and I guess his face would start to shine even more in God's presence. When he came back out to speak to the people, he'd put the veil on, because they were all rather frightened by this bright, shining light. And of course, I think we know that when we are changed, when we are born again, then our faces shall shine brightly. So in a sense, Moses is just typifying what's going to happen to us one day. I don't know if you've seen any artists' representations at all of Moses. I've seen a couple of paintings that are obviously nothing like him, but that's what people think he may have looked like. And you often get two sort of rays of light shining out of Moses' forehead. Sometimes it's shown as little sort of horns on his forehead. Sometimes it's two sort of beams, like he's got a torch in his brain, and you get these sort of rays or beams shining out. That apparently comes from a mistranslation in the Latin version of the Bible, because in the Hebrew, there's a word for shining, to shine, to be radiant, but that was mistranslated in the Latin version of the Bible, which of course was used for thousands of years, for centuries, and they translated that not as radiance or shining, but as a beam of light or a horn of light. It's a very similar word that they've sort of mistaken it for. So therefore, you know, the Latins and the Romans and the artists that came through the Catholic Church were used to reading about these horns of light or beams of light. That's why sometimes you'll see these alleged pictures of Moses with two sort of bright, like headlamps, shining out of his forehead. Right, on to chapter 35. Then Moses gathered all the congregation of the children of Israel together and said to them, "These are the words which the Eternal has commanded you to do." And he's about to explain to them all the materials they would need to actually start putting together all the different articles, the altars, and so on. And before he started that, he thought he'd better remind them of one sort of key law, which is that here they were in the middle of the wilderness with not much, frankly, to do. They're about to start working with quite a bit of enthusiasm on this beautiful tabernacle, the curtains and the altars and the golden ark and so on. It would have been very, very tempting for these people in their enthusiasm, in their excitement, as they were doing the work of God, to probably carry on doing it 7 days a week until they finished, which would not have done. God's Sabbath is far more important. It's a key principle So before we get into the details, says Moses, here's an important reminder. Verse 2, work, including the following work, shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh day shall be a holy day for you, a Sabbath of rest to the eternal. Now, whoever does any work on it, even for the tabernacle, shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations on the Sabbath day. Now, some people take that right out of context and say, well, there you are, you can't even put fire on the Sabbath. And that'd be great if you were up in northern Wisconsin in December or January, and the temperature's minus whatever it is up there, minus 500 degrees Fahrenheit or something, and you're sitting there and you're blue, your teeth are chattering, but you can't put the fire on because it's the Sabbath. Excuse me. That's not what God's on about in the slightest. He's on about, you know, part of the work he's about to commence is about melting metals to make altars and cherubim and all sorts of fancy things. So make sure, amongst other things, you don't start smelting and getting your furnaces going on the Sabbath. The Sabbath must be a day when you cease all of your labors. You must do that. Verse 4. And Moses spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, this is the thing which the Eternal commanded, saying, take from among you an offering to the Eternal. Whoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it as an offering to the Eternal. Gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, scarlet yarn, fine linen thread, goat's hair, ram's skins dyed red, badger skins, which might be, as you said earlier, porpoise or dolphin skins, and acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil, and for the sweet incense, onyx stones, and stones to be set in the ephod and in the breastplate. All who are skillful among you shall come and make all that the Eternal has commanded, the tabernacle, its tent, its covering, its clasps, its boards, bars, pillars, sockets, the ark and its poles, with the mercy seat. As we said before, the word mercy isn't the Hebrew, nor the word seat. This is a golden lid which covered the ark. And the veil of the covering, the table, its poles, its utensils, the showbread. Also the lampstand, or the menorah, for the light, its utensils. Verse 15, the incense altar, its poles, the anointing oil, the sweet incense, the screen for the door at the entrance of the tabernacle, the altar burnt offering with its bronze grating, its poles. Verse 17, the hangings of the court. Verse 18, the pegs of the tabernacle. Verse 19, the garments of ministry for ministering in the holy place, the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and the garments of his sons to minister as priests. So that's a whole big bunch of things that you are to bring. If, says God, you have a willing heart. And I think without turning there, we know that God looks for those who do not give out of compulsion. In the King James, it says out of necessity. God really wants only things that come from us from a generous heart. If we can't do it with a generous, giving heart, then I guess God prefers us not to do it at all. He doesn't want something that we give with resentment into his work, wherever his work might be. Verse 20, and all the congregation of the children of Israel departed from the presence of Moses. Then everyone came whose heart was stirred, and everyone whose spirit was willing. That rather implies that not everybody was willing, of course. It says those who were willing, those whose hearts were stirred up, did the following. So I take it that there would be a number of people among the people of Israel who did not have willing hearts and so stood back and just perhaps complained about the waste of all this wealth and so on. That would be fairly typical of Israelites. And they brought the Eternal's offering for the work of the tabernacle of meeting, for all its service, and for the holy garments. They came, both men and women, as many as had a willing heart, and only those, and that's what God looks for today, and brought earrings and nose rings and rings and necklaces, all jewelry of gold, that is, every man who offered an offering of gold to the Eternal, and every man with whom was found blue and purple and scarlet, fine linen, goat's hair, red skins of rams and badger skins brought them. Everyone who offered an offering of silver or bronze brought the Eternal's offering. Everyone with whom was found acacia wood for any work of the service brought it. All the women who were gifted artisans spun yarn with their hands and brought what they had spun of blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen. And all the women whose hearts stirred with wisdom spun yarn of goat's hair. You see, people brought what they had in their generosity, and it didn't make a lot of difference to God whether you're a rich person bringing, you know, barrel loads of gold, or you're a poorer person who could just, you know, spin and weave. You brought your skill, you brought your willingness to serve in whatever way you could. And I think God's always been that way. He's not always out for the big shot. Many times in the past, I'm sure, in the recent times of the work of God, there'll be many people who have probably given many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars into the work of God, which is absolutely fine and marvelous. Equally, there have been many people who have not had much money at all, but who have probably labored in prayer, you know, for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour at a time for, you know, God's work and so on. And that's, for God's purposes, that's absolutely fine. You know, you bring what you've got. You give to God what you've got. God's looking for the willing heart, not for the dollar signs and so on. Verse 27, the rulers brought onyx stones and the stones to be set in the ephod and in the breastplate. Verse 29, the children of Israel brought a freewill offering to the Eternal, all the men and women whose hearts were willing to bring material for all kinds of work which the Eternal, by the hand of Moses, had commanded to be done. And Moses said to the children of Israel, see, the Eternal has called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and understanding, in knowledge and all manner of workmanship, to design artistic works, to work in gold and silver and bronze, in cutting jewels for setting, in carving wood, and to work in all manner of artistic workmanship. And he's put in his heart the ability to teach, in him and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan. He has filled them with skill to do all manner of work of the engraver and the designer and the tapestry maker in blue, in purple, in scarlet and fine linen, and of the weaver, those who do every work, and those who design artistic works. So not only do these individuals have great natural aptitude, but God had added to them with a marvelous ability directly from his own mind, putting a spirit in these men and their helpers that allow them to do fantastic handiwork, superb craftsmanship, to make what must have been the most outstanding sculptures and decorative work ever seen upon this earth, using tens of millions of dollars of material. Really quite dramatic. And, you know, looking at verse 34 just for a moment, it refers in verse 34 that God has put in his heart the ability to teach. I was just thinking earlier that, you know, God can give individuals, you know, great abilities. And I'm fairly convinced in my own mind that in recent times that God did give Mr. Herbert Armstrong, you know, a special ability to teach. Mr. Armstrong had a very interesting life, of course, had many, many experiences growing up and learning the ropes and so on. But there's one thing that really sets Mr. Armstrong apart, in my personal view. It was his ability to make the truth plain. You know, so many of Mr. Armstrong's writings, whether it's about the Sabbath or predestination or the world tomorrow or the meaning of the holy days or whatever, really, Mr. Armstrong seemed to have a unique ability to make these things easy to understand. As a teacher, I think, you know, he'd take some beating. And I would imagine that the situation was just like mentioned here, that God gave Mr. Herbert Armstrong a special supernatural ability to teach. And perhaps many today don't have that same ability, but think they do. Carrying on to verse 1 of chapter 36. And Bezalel and Aholiab and every gifted artisan in whom the Eternal has put wisdom and understanding, to know how to do all manner of work for the service of the sanctuary, shall do according to all that the Eternal has commanded. Then Moses called Bezalel and Aholiab and every gifted artisan in whose heart the Eternal had put wisdom, everyone whose heart was stirred to come and do the work. And they received from Moses all the offering which the children of Israel had brought for the work of the service of making the sanctuary. So they continued bringing to him freewill offerings every morning. You know, these people were, well, perhaps they're still a bit guilty and trying to make up for their recent bad behavior by, you know, bringing these extra offerings in. Verse 4, then all the craftsmen who were doing all the work of the sanctuary came, each from the work he was doing, and they spoke to Moses, saying, the people bring much more than enough for the service of the work which the Eternal commanded us to do. You know, it's too much. We don't need all this. Verse 6, so Moses gave a commandment, and they caused it to be proclaimed throughout the camp, saying, let neither man nor woman do any more work for the offering of the sanctuary. And the people were restrained from bringing, for the material they had was sufficient for all the work to be done, indeed, too much. And that shows, hopefully, a very great generosity among the people. And it also shows quite a bit of honesty among these artisans and craftsmen. Because I think in some occasions today, some business people might well continue to take offerings thinking, well, we don't need all this, but I've got a special bank account in Switzerland, that's where this lot's going. But over here, these men said, Moses, have we got enough gold and silver? Come to stop bringing it. We, you know, there's far too much here. And so that was a good example. The next couple of chapters I think we're going to skip over fairly briefly, because what we now get is the actual construction, preparation, the making of the various bits of furniture, the curtains and so on and so forth. And we did spend, you know, two complete Sabbaths going over these items in considerable detail, so I don't want to just repeat that again. So that should allow us to make fairly good progress over the next couple of chapters. So we'll skip these fairly rapidly. Verse 8, then all the gifted artisans among them who worked on the tabernacle made 10 curtains woven of fine linen thread and blue and purple and scarlet yarn with artistic designs of cherubim. They made them. And I think we did comment first time round that the colors probably are significant. You know, fine linen thread could picture, you know, righteousness because it's pure white. The blue would be a color that might represent the sky or heaven. The purple has always been a symbol of royalty. And scarlet, of course, when you're thinking of Jesus' sacrifice, is by his shed blood, by his red shed blood, that we are redeemed. So the colors are, you know, probably all quite significant. Coming down to verse 14, in addition, he made curtains of goat's hair for the tent over the tabernacle. He made 11 curtains made out of the hair of goats. Then verse 19, then he made a covering for the tent of ram's skins dyed red, and a covering of badger skins, or possibly dolphin or porpoise skins above that. As we saw last time, there were four layers over this particular tent containing the Holy of Holies. Verse 20, for the tabernacle, he made boards of acacia wood standing upright. Dropping down to verse 34, he overlaid the boards with gold, made their rings of gold to be holders for the bars, and overlaid the bars with gold. These were the walls of the tabernacle of the holy place, made of acacia wood boards, like big planks, but each one overlaid in gold. Verse 35, and he made a veil woven of blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen thread. It was woven with an artistic design of cherubim. That, like I said before, the word veil, to me at least, is not a very helpful word. It sort of signifies something very thin that you could see through, like over a lady's face at a wedding. But this is more of a partition or a screen or a curtain made of these yarns and so on, which separates the most holy place from the other part of the tabernacle. Verse 37, he also made a screen for the tabernacle door, woven of blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen thread made by a weaver. Chapter 37, verse 1. Then Bezalel made the ark of acacia wood. 2.5 cubits was its length, 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. He overlaid it with pure gold inside and outside, and made a moulding of gold all around it. This was the sort of pièce de résistance. This was the key item in the Holy of Holies. This was the ark, or the chest, which would contain the 2 tablets of the Ten Commandments, and later on a jug of manna and Aaron's rod that budded. But at the moment, it's just going to be the 2 tablets of stone. Dropping down to verse 6, he also made the mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits was its length, and 1.5 cubits its width. And as we said before, really the better translation is a gold cover, or a golden lid, which sat upon the chest and enclosed it. And then on top of that, verse 7, he made 2 cherubim of beaten gold. He made them of 1 piece at the 2 ends of the mercy seat, or this golden lid. 1 cherub at 1 end on this side, the other cherub at the other end on that side. He made the cherubim at the 2 ends of 1 piece with the mercy seat. The cherubim spread out their wings above and covered the mercy seat with their wings. They faced one another. The faces of the cherubim were toward the mercy seat, or the golden lid that covered. Verse 10, he made the table of acacia wood. 2 cubits was its length, 1 cubit its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. And he overlaid it with pure gold, and made a moulding of gold all around it. And we know that was the table on which the 12 loaves of showbread were later put. Dropping down to verse 17. He also made the lampstand, or the menorah, of pure gold. Of hammered work he made the lampstand. Verse 18, and 6 branches came out of its sides, 3 branches of the lampstand out of one side, 3 branches out the other side, and of course the bit in the middle, making a total of 7. And I think we speculated last time that if we looked at Revelation chapter 1, there was a pretty strong indication that a 7-branched lampstand or candlestick represents the 7 eras of the Church of God, and therefore the whole Church of God. Dropping down to verse 25, he also made the incense altar of acacia wood. Its length was 1 cubit, its width 1 cubit, it was square, and 2 cubits was its height. Its horns were of 1 piece with it, and he overlaid it with pure gold, its top, its sides all around, and its horns, and he also made for it a moulding of gold all around it. Verse 29, he also made the holy anointing oil, and the pure incense of sweet spices, according to the work of the perfumer. So we've been through these particular items of furniture in a fair amount of detail, and I think we saw that the incense that was burned on this altar represented the prayers of the saints, and we find that in God's genuine heavenly throne room, in Revelation, I think, 4 or 5 we found it, there is actually an incense altar mentioned there. So these were real items with a real type up there in heaven. Chapter 38. He made the altar of burnt offering of acacia wood. 5 cubits was its length, and 5 cubits its width, it was square, and its height was 3 cubits. He made its horns and its 4 corners. The horns were 1 piece with it, and he overlaid it with bronze, not gold as in the incense altar. That was the golden altar. This was the much bigger altar, something like about 7 or 8 feet square, on which the carcasses of animals would be burned and a grating to catch the ashes and all the shovels and spades and bits and pieces they would need as well. Dropping down to verse 8, and he made the laver of bronze and its base of bronze from the bronze mirrors of the serving women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So this would be a wash bowl or a wash basin in which the priests would have to wash their hands and feet when they were conducting their service. Verse 9, then he made the court. On the south side, the hangings of the court were woven of fine linen, 100 cubits long. And of course, we then get equally hangings for the north and the east and the west. Dropping down to verse 21, this is the inventory of the tabernacle of the testimony, which was counted according to the commandment of Moses for the service of the Levites by the hand of Ithamar, son of Aaron the priest. Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, made all that the Eternal had commanded Moses. And with him was Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, an engraver and designer, a weaver in blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen thread. All the gold that was used in all the work of the holy place, that is, the gold of the offering, was 29 talents and 730 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. That's a particular sized shekel. And the silver from those who were numbered of the congregation was 100 talents and 1,775 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. Dropping down to verse 27, and from the 100 talents of silver were cast the sockets of the sanctuary and the bases of the veil. 100 sockets from the 100 talents, one talent for each socket. So this is really a measurement being made of all the metals and, in a sense, the value of them that were put into the tabernacle to construct it. My verse in the Bible here has got a figure against the silver here in verse 27. It talks 100 talents of silver, it reckons, is $38 million. This Bible version is fairly recent print, about 10, 12 years old. So I guess that figure is perhaps broadly correct, something like, you know, $40 million just for these silver sockets. I tried to work out earlier how much the gold is worth, but I couldn't quite figure out the size of a talent. There's a bit of debate over that, and equally the value of gold and so on. But I think it would be fair to say that this particular tabernacle in the wilderness was something like between $100 and $200 million in value, which is really quite outstanding in terms of a portable tent and its furniture wandering its way through the wilderness. Really quite remarkable. Dropping down now to verse 39, we leave the actual furniture and the construction part and move on now to the garments, which also to be made, you know, for the priests. Chapter 39, verse 1, and again, we have looked at these in some detail, and those of you who are on the email list, I did send out a number of sort of photographs showing as best as one could the artists, the representations of these garments and much of the furniture, just to help us have a bit better clue what these things might look like. But verse 1, of the blue and purple and scarlet thread, they made garments of ministry for ministering in the holy place, and made the holy garments for Aaron as Eternal had commanded Moses. He made the ephod of gold and blue and purple and scarlet thread and of fine linen thread. And they beat the gold into thin sheets and cut it into threads to work it in with the blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen thread into artistic designs. So really, you know, quite a beautiful garment, super colors, but with the gold thread, you know, woven in and out. So really quite outstanding. Coming down to verse 8, and he made the breastplate, artistically woven like the workmanship of the ephod of gold and blue and purple and scarlet thread and fine linen thread. Coming down to verse 14, there were 12 stones according to the names of the sons of Israel, according to their names, engraved like a signet, each one with his own name, according to the 12 tribes. You may recollect the breastplate was about 9 inches square, and there were 12 stones set into it, each stone having the name of, you know, Reuben or Issachar or Dan and so on, so that when the high priest would wear his breastplate and go before God, in a sense he would be representing, you know, all 12 tribes. Dropping down to verse 22, he made the robe of the ephod of woven work, all of blue. Dropping down to verse 30, then they made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold, and wrote on it an inscription like the engraving of a signet, holiness to the Eternal. And they tied it to a blue cord to fasten it above on the turban as the Eternal had commanded Moses. Verse 32, thus all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting was finished. And the children of Israel did according to all that the Eternal had commanded Moses, so they did. And they brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent, and all its furnishings, its clasps, its boards, bars, pillars, sockets, the covering of ram skins dyed red, the covering of badger skins or dolphins, whatever, the veil of the covering, the Ark of the Testimony with its poles, the mercy seat, the table, its utensils, the showbread, the pure lampstand with its lamps, the lamps set in order, its utensils, the oil for light, the gold altar, the anointing oil, and the sweet incense, the screen for the tabernacle door, the bronze altar, its grate of bronze, its poles, all its utensils, the laver with its base, the hangings of the court, I think we get the idea, verse 41, the garments of ministry to minister in the holy place, the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and his son's garments to minister as priests, according to all that the Eternal had commanded Moses. So the children of Israel did all the work. Then Moses looked over all the work, or examined all the work, and indeed, they had done it, as the Eternal had commanded, just so they had done it. And Moses blessed them or praised them. So it would seem to have taken something like the best part of 5 or 6 months to have done all this work, which in some ways is quite a short time, but when you've got God's Spirit giving you extra super ability and skill in craftsmanship, then I guess that means you don't make mistakes. If you don't make mistakes, you can keep on moving more rapidly. You haven't got to keep repairing all the errors you've made. So I think it's, 6 months is a fair time in other ways to be out there beavering away at making curtains and coverings and cutting boards to size and smelting all the gold and pouring the gold and getting the cherubim carved and shaped and so on. But a really very industrious period for these people. And after 6 months, they've made all the bits and pieces, brought them up to Moses, which had taken, I'm sure, quite a while, and then said, okay, Moses, what do you make of it? And so he walked around and examined the cherubim and looked at the ark and checked out the lampstand and looked at the breastplate, looked at the stones, looked at all the different garments and said, pretty good. That's exactly as it was described to me. You've done precisely what God ordered, and he blessed them or praised them and said, well done, superb job. Moving on now to chapter 40, which you'll notice is the last chapter in the book. So we got there. Wasn't sure we would, but we moved fairly rapidly today for a change. Chapter 40, verse 1. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, okay, lad, it's all ready. On the first day of the first month of this next year, you shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. So, if you remember, they had left Egypt about 11 months earlier, on the 15th day of the first month. We don't know for sure how many months were in that particular year. Some Hebrew years have got 13 months. Most often it's 12 months. If we assume a 12-month year here, that means that the tabernacle would be set up 11 months and 15 days or so after they left Egypt. It had been a very interesting 11 months for them, of course. And the last 5 or 6 months is spent doing all this work. Okay, so on the first day of the first month, you shall set up or erect the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. And there's two words there. Tabernacle is a Hebrew word, mishkan, and tent is another Hebrew word, ohel. So these are two quite distinct words in some ways. Mishkan was the whole thing, the tent, the courtyard, and all the bits and pieces, whereas the tent part was the small unit in which was the Holy of Holies and so on. Verse 3, you shall put in it the Ark of the Testimony, that's the Ten Commandments, and partition off the Ark with the veil, or this special screen. You shall bring in the table and arrange the things that are to be set in order on it. And you shall bring in the lampstand and light its lamps. So this is now the whole tabernacle, the Mishkan, being completely erected for its very first time. You shall also set the altar of gold for the incense before the Ark of the Testimony, and put up the screen for the door of the tabernacle. Then you shall set the altar of the burnt offering before the door of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. And you shall set the laver, or wash basin, between the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, and put water in it. You shall set up the court all around, and hang up the screen at the court gate. And you shall take the anointing oil, and anoint the tabernacle, and all that is in it. And you shall hallow it, and all its utensils, and it shall be holy. You shall anoint the altar of the burnt offering, and all its utensils, and sanctify the altar. The altar shall be most holy. And you shall anoint the laver and its base, and sanctify it. Then you shall bring Aaron and his sons to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and wash them with water. You shall put the holy garments on Aaron, and anoint him, and sanctify him, that he may minister to me as priest. And this was probably quite a special occasion in a sense, you know, after all that preparatory work. Here was the most beautiful tent, I guess, in the earth at that time, with all these marvelous items in it being assembled, put together, and then you've got to bring the high priest, and for the first time put these special garments on him, the robe and the ephod and the breastplate, place the Urim and Thummim in the breastplate area too, the turban on his head, and the gold crown that says holiness to the eternal, and a marvelous occasion inaugurating the high priest for service. And of course the high priest would represent Jesus Christ and what he does for us as our high priest, and then of course actually anoint him, which is to pour, you know, the holy oil of anointing all over Aaron. And I think there's no question that God was really delighted at this stage, very impressed, and it was a marvelous moment in Israel's history. We can tell that because if we hold our finger there and turn to Psalms 133, a psalm we're quite familiar with. This is a psalm which I believe was Mr. Armstrong's mother's favorite psalm. Psalms 133. We may as well read all of it, it's only three verses long. Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. And these days you could always add, and how very rare. But nonetheless, it's something that God thinks very highly of. When brethren can dwell together in unity, in harmony, you know, as one to God, it's a marvelous thing to behold. I guess it is for us too, and something that we can't do very often these days. But what a marvelous thing to see the sons and daughters of God, the brethren actually coexisting in harmony, as friends, helping and serving and being at one. And how does God, told us to compare that? Verse 2, it is like the precious oil upon the head running down on the beard of Aaron running down on the edge of his garments. So that was a comparison that God uses here, or inspired here, and David actually wrote the psalm, but to David, that event when Aaron was ordained, it was a wonderful time, marvelous, an emotional time. As he says, it's like the precious oil upon Aaron's head, running down his beard and his garments, setting him apart as a high priest to represent, in a sense, Jesus Christ. That was a marvelous event, says David, and under inspiration, because God's preserved this in Scripture for us. Carrying on, verse 3, it is like the dew of Hermon descending upon the mountains of Zion, for there the Eternal commanded the blessing, life forevermore. So we can tell from that one little short psalm that this event, which is rather hurried over in Exodus 40, was still a tremendous event with a great deal of meaning to those that participated, to King David later, and I'm sure to God too. Verse 14, and you shall bring his sons and clothe them with tunics. You shall anoint them as you anointed their father, that they may minister to me as priests. For their anointing shall surely be an everlasting priesthood throughout their generations. Thus Moses did, according to all that the Eternal commanded him, so he did. And it came to pass, in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was raised up. So Moses raised up the tabernacle, fastened its sockets, set up its boards, put in its bars, raised up its pillars. He spread out the tent over the tabernacle, and put the covering of the tent on top of it, as the Eternal had commanded Moses. He took the testimony, that's the stones with the Ten Commandments, and put it into the ark, inserted the poles through the rings of the ark, and put the mercy seat, or the golden covering, on top of the ark. He brought the ark into the tabernacle, hung up the veil of the covering, and partitioned off the ark of the testimony, as the Eternal had commanded Moses. And remember, only once a year Once a year, on the Day of Atonement, could the high priest go behind that partition to where the Ark of the Covenant was. You and I can do this anytime. The curtain's been removed for us. He put the table in the tabernacle of meeting on the north side of the tabernacle outside the veil. He set the bread in order upon it before the Eternal, as the Eternal commanded Moses. That's the showbread, as it was called. He put the lampstand in the tabernacle of meeting across from the table on the south side of the tabernacle. And he lit the lamps before the Eternal, as the Eternal had commanded Moses. He put the gold altar in the tabernacle of meeting in front of the veil. And he burned sweet incense on it, as the Eternal had commanded Moses. He hung up the screen at the door of the tabernacle. And he put the altar of burnt offering before the door of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting, and offered upon it the burnt offering and the grain offering, as the Eternal had commanded Moses. Moses is quite good at obeying commandments, by the way. Which I think we see here, that's probably one reason that God could use him so powerfully. By and large, with a few little mistakes, Moses obeyed God. We would do well, I think, to imitate Moses in that sense. He set the laver between the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, and put water there for washing. And Moses, Aaron, and his sons washed their hands and their feet with water from it. When they went into the tabernacle of meeting, and when they came near the altar, they washed, as the Eternal had commanded Moses. And he raised up the court all around the tabernacle and the altar, and hung up the screen of the court gate. So Moses finished the work. That's it all now ready for use. It's assembled after all that work, and it's sitting there in the wilderness. Verse 34, then the cloud, not a cloud, but the cloud in which God was usually hiding himself, covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. So this was something even more spectacular in a sense. This cloud, which they were used to, they had gone before them since the days of the Red Sea and so on, descended right over this this new tent area, and then the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. One imagines bright shining lights, fires burning, and all sorts of strange radiations and things. But that's just my imagination, it may be quite different. Verse 35, and Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting, because the cloud rested above it, and the glory of the Eternal filled the tabernacle. When the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, the children of Israel went onward in all their journeys. So this is a sort of postscript in a sense. The actual story is now finished, and there's just a reference here to what happened in subsequent months and years, which was that when the cloud rested on the tabernacle, the people stayed there. They didn't move. They just kept on living in that area until, as it says, verse 37, if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not journey till the day that it was taken up. And when the cloud would rise up and move, the people would pack up all their tents, their belongings, get their cattle and flocks together, and prepare to follow. When the cloud would descend back over the area, and stop, they would stop, set up camp, and stay for weeks, months, or even more than a year. Verse 38, for the cloud of the Eternal was above the tabernacle by day, and fire was over it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. So the next 40-odd years, pretty much, as we found out in other times, this tabernacle would be covered by the cloud in the daytime. At night, when it was dark, a fire would burn over the tabernacle, really quite impressive, and giving the people, if you like, that assurance that God was there in their midst. And of course, when it would rise up and move, it would tell them it's time to go, and it would also show them the direction to go in. And we might think, well, that's pretty handy to think that this cloud would be there before you and would lead you this way and then turn and go the other way, and it would settle down when it's time to stop. When it's safe to move on, it would rise up and so on and so forth. And it was obviously a great physical help and very impressive to ancient Israel. But you and I have something that is many ways superior to that. If we just, you have to hold your place there because I'm not coming back. That's us finished with Exodus. But we turn to Romans chapter 8 just for a moment as our closing scripture. Romans chapter 8. And starting in verse 8, I think, when you find it. just want to draw an illustration here between the way the cloud or the fire acted as a guide to ancient Israel, taking them unerringly through the wilderness, telling them when to stop and when to move. And if we pick up the story here in Romans 8, starting in verse 8, excuse me. So then, those who are in the flesh cannot please God, but you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. And if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his. So here's Paul talking about the Spirit of God dwelling in us, which, if you think about it, is far more important than God dwelling among the people in a physical tent. That's what he did in those days, but here God dwells in us, in our flesh. Verse 10, and if Christ is in you, you know, far superior to dwelling in his tent among the people, the body is dead because of sin, but the Spirit is life because of righteousness. But if the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies through his Spirit which dwells in you. And by the way, it's an interesting clue in verse 11 about this God's Spirit dwelling in us. It does say that God's Spirit will give life to our mortal bodies. And in Greek, there is a separate word for a dead body compared to a mortal body. And the Greek here is referring to mortal bodies, which is what you and I have got today. We have mortal bodies. At the end of our lives, you know, they will die. But currently they are mortal bodies, not dead bodies. But it does say here that God's Spirit actually gives life to our mortal bodies. And there is a clearly some sort of hint there that if we have God's Spirit in us, it can actually, in some strange way, energize and give real life even to our physical mortal bodies. But carrying on, dropping down to verse 14, which was the point I was trying to come to. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are sons and daughters of God. So you see, for you and I today, we don't have to look to a tent or a tabernacle some hundreds of yards away. We're not excluded by courtyards. We don't have to bring animal sacrifices. We're not forever excluded from the Holy of Holies. We're not like the high priest who once a year only could enter with some trepidation before the Ark of the Testimony. For you and I today, we are in a far, far better situation. We are the temple of God today. God dwells in his people. We have God's Spirit within us. And as it says here, that you and I should be, could be, ought to be led by God's Spirit. And really, we should develop the sort of spiritual sensitivity to be able to follow God's Spirit and to be alert to God's promptings through his Word or his Spirit directly, so that we have far more efficient ability to go the right way than ancient Israel, who would be following this physical cloud that they could see above them. Well, okay, brethren, that's been quite a long stretch of time since we began our Exodus story. 40 chapters, quite a long book. But I hope for many of us it's been an interesting experience. I'm not sure I've read the book of Exodus all the way through, not as carefully and slowly, for many, many years. So I've certainly enjoyed going through it and learning quite a bit from it. There'll be a slight break, I think, between now and the next Bible study. I'll be taking perhaps a couple of weeks or so to review which way to go next, and waiting for the Spirit of God to lead, I suppose. Also, we've got Pentecost 2 weeks tomorrow, and that'll be a bit of an interruption in our schedules in any event. So I'll communicate one more time next time when a future Bible study or perhaps sermon is underway. But for now, we'll close the Bible study and ask Henry if he'd kindly give us the final closing prayer.